in one of Arnold Bennett's last novels. There's a highly social woman who surprises her friends by deciding she would like to read Shakespeare and the Bible for the first time in her life as a kind of diversion. She's not dull, but she has never bothered to read either of those classics, and she thinks it might be time to see what is there. One day she came to the 46th Psalm, and she rather liked the opening sentence. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. She read on through some rather dull stuff and was ready to skip somewhere else when her eyes fell on the words, "Be still and know that I am God." She was not sure just what the words meant, but she was startled by such a blunt imperative, "Be still," and by a kind of majesty in the sentence. She told her friends, who said they didn't know the exact meaning either, but that they too felt the magic in the style, some deep serenity in the words that spoke to their hectic lives like a voice from a different world. They took the matter no further, although once in a while they would talk again about how it was that even when they simply spoke them out loud, the words seemed great. "Be still and know that I am God." Let's leave the name of God out of it for a moment and simply consider the principle of being still in order to know almost anything worth knowing. It has always seemed right to me that Sir Isaac Newton was in a garden by himself, not talking, in solitary thought, when the apple fell and prompted him to expound the law of gravity. If he had been playing croquet with his friends, he would likely not have seen it fall, and certainly would not have been likely to brood on it until he realized what it meant. I think of someone like Galileo, who must have spent an incredible number of solitary hours looking into the heavens. A crowd would have ruined him. He spent all those lonely times until he finally got, in Wordsworth's beautiful line, "the harvest of a quiet eye." When you have forgotten everything else in this sermon, the poet's phrase would be good to live with: "the harvest of a quiet eye." Let me tell you about another man who got a harvest in the same way. I know what a bad press he has had from some believers, but Charles Darwin is one of my choice examples of how indomitable the quiet and patient spirit can be. Unless you have read carefully about his life, you cannot imagine how much time he spent in solitude, classifying his beetles hour after hour, day after day, reading books, brooding on what he had learned. He did not, of course, discover the theory of evolution. His grandfather had written about evolution long before. The idea was in the air among scientists while Darwin was growing up. What Darwin did was 20 years of solitary labor that built, under the theory of evolution, a foundation of evidence so massive that it was impossible for any thoughtful person in England or in the world, finally, to simply disregard it. But what will impress you if you read about him is how quiet a life Darwin lived. He might as well have had a sign above his study door, "Be still and know." I will sound hopelessly old-fashioned and quaint to anyone under 30, but I believe this next thing I am about to say, that there is a tragic excess of noise and rush in modern life, and that we pay a price for it so high we cannot even start to comprehend it. Racket in the workplace, trucks and planes and sirens around the neighborhood, movie ads that deafen us before the feature starts. I often wonder if I'm the only man in the movie house who puts both hands over the ears until the ads have been completed. Kids, desperate, no matter where they are, how beautiful a spot to get to the video arcade with its electronic chatter. Kids who once, when there was nothing to do, would slip off to a pond or read a book or simply dream of possibilities while the dust motes danced lazily in the shafts of sunlight. Becoming something in the solitude and silence. A wise Englishman from the last century, a man by the name of Matthew Arnold, who didn't know yet about cars and planes, said his countrymen were always rushing about so much that we never once possess our souls before we die. I'm never quite sure what people mean when they talk about their souls, but I suppose Arnold meant the quintessential self, the deep and true self, the inner core of thought and reflection that makes us different from anyone else on earth. It seemed to Arnold already that most of his friends were finding themselves such intolerable bores that they had to go somewhere and be with somebody, preferably a friend, but even an enemy, rather than solitude, running, you begin to think, from themselves. But 70 miles an hour on the highway is not fast enough to get away from the self. And 500 miles an hour on a plane only changes the place quickly. We go to a foreign country. Perhaps the self won't find us. We chatter, rub elbows with crowds at all the tourist spots, go where everybody else goes, watch what everybody else watches. Our sacred literature came out of the Near East. And to most Orientals, this constant hurry is incomprehensible. For them, meditation has been the noblest activity. They have known something of what Goethe meant. A talent grows in solitude. A character in the stream of the world. It's a wise saying. Solitude is a good place to visit, a poor place to live. To become something, you have to spend quiet time alone. To act on what you have become, you get back out into the world to meet its challenge. But somewhere in solitude or in quiet, you have to grow the talent. Be still and know. Otherwise, there is nothing in the bank. When you need to write a check on conviction or serenity or wisdom, a poet no one remembers, writing in the time of Shakespeare, wrote the topic sentence for this sermon. My mind, to me, a kingdom is. A whole kingdom with a sovereign and subjects, laws and recreations, playgrounds and parks. I've spent a lifetime looking into students' minds. There are not as many kingdoms there as you'd like. More of those little unincorporated villages you pass out in western Kansas, thinking, is life in this place as dull as it looks? It wouldn't have to be dull if there were people living there whose minds were populated with a few thousand thoughts. But those are born in useful solitude, and solitude, even in those places, is often hard to come by. Well, this is a sermon, not a lecture in sociology. And we are a church, not a seminar in graduate school, so what does all this have to do with religion? Someone said that people's religion is what they do with their solitude. That requires some thought, but if it means that the soul is dyed with the color of its leisure thoughts, and that as a woman thinks in her heart, so is she, then it's true. And it's a frightening idea. How many of us really want to be what we think about when we have an hour to spare? That is, if there ever is an hour to spare. T.S. Eliot seemed to have some doubts. Where is the life we have lost in living? Where is the wisdom we have lost in knowledge? Where is the knowledge we have lost in information? Endless invention, endless experiment, bring knowledge of motion, but not of stillness. Knowledge of speech, but not of silence. Knowledge of words and ignorance of the word. Eliot knew the Christian gospel better than most of us. He was thinking of that place in John that says the word became flesh and dwelt among us. So he says, be still and know, or you will not finally even know Christ himself. Robert Louis Stevenson described Eliot's restless people, who in terms of mental currency are penniless. He called them dead alive people, with a mind vacant of all material for amusement, and not one thought to rub against another while waiting for a train. If you don't have one thought to rub against another when you are caught now in a moment of enforced idleness, you simply put the Walkman earphones on your head and get some music, and usually the kind that puts an end to solitude and reflection. I was walking in a park the other day, listening to different bird song, watching the pattern of sun through leaves, stopping to wonder what the little skitter was in the brush, rabbit or squirrel, standing motionless for about 5 minutes once to see where a nervous mother bird had her nest, wanting to keep in touch with a world that was here before we were. The young man came up behind me, walking fast, his eyes glazed over, his head bobbing up and down, the rock and roll so loud that I could hear it out of his headphones as he danced by me. He would laugh at the idea that he loses something, not to hear the quiet sounds, out of sync with the slow and natural rhythms of life. But I think he does lose. And I will admit I'm probably selfish, because I have a sense that unless he does get in touch with other rhythms, nothing we could ever offer here would interest him at all. A time to keep silence. Not all the time, but sometimes. The Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. Surely you get out sometimes early in the morning, before anything starts and while the dew is still on the grass, and you worship the Lord while the earth around is silent. It's the best time I know. But I must confess that people I know extremely well prefer the hush of evening. It doesn't matter if only you can get away from noise and motion to be still and know. Because of the way I have spent my life with the written word and the spoken, I hear words very clearly when I see them on the page. I taste them too and smell them, but that has nothing to do with this sermon. What is important is that I hear them, and so many of them are screaming at the tops of their voices, on billboards, in newspaper ads. I look for a movie. The theater ads shout at me. Terrific, daring, sensational, blood-curdling. Each one plays up the eccentric, the extravagant, the monstrous, the violent. I suppose the hypesters have learned that it would be the death knell of a film to say, here is a quiet, thoughtful little movie you're likely to remember for a while. Quiet, thoughtful, those are not the in words for the second half of the 20th century. Which may be part of the reason why this century, of all the centuries, has made a public proclamation that God is dead, lost in the constant racket. This God who said, be still and know that I am God. Do you remember the story of Elijah the prophet? You heard a little of it not long ago. Who left a big crowd and lots of noise and excitement, and fled to Mount Horeb for a little visit with God. So what happened when he got there? Well, first there was a mighty wind, so strong it tore the mountains and shattered the rocks. But the author says, the Lord was not in the wind. After the wind, an earthquake. But he says the Lord was not in the earthquake either. And after the quake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. All those noisy, busy, powerful things, and God was not in them. So where was he? After the fire came what the Bible calls a still, small voice. Or what in Hebrew is more literally the sound of a gentle stillness. I don't know who wrote that story, but I think I know what he was trying to tell me. that Elijah needed to find God somewhere besides in the wild competition on Mount Carmel with people shouting at one another and the nerves drawn tight. I know why I say these things, and it's not to fill the space of 20 minutes. I say them because our relationship is based on the idea that we are here to find and worship God. And because, like that woman I mentioned as we began this morning, I have found few words in any literature in all the world that seem so true to me as these: be still and know that I am God.